Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Vikram Chandra, whose latest novel is Sacred Games. Earlier novel is Red Earth and Pouring Rain, and a collection of short stories, Love and Longing in Bombay. Vikram Chandra grew up in New Delhi, went to film school at Columbia, dropped out of film school to become a writer. Your mentors are John Barth and Donald Barthelme?
Yeah.
Vikram Chandra, Sacred Games is a huge, sprawling novel that encompasses all of Bombay. There are so many different places to start, but let's start with the beginnings of the book. It starts as a crime thriller and moves into, I guess, a social novel and broadens out from there. But I understand it began with an image of a gangster inside his home. Is that correct?
Right. Well, inside his very strange-looking cube-like bunker of a home. And I think that image first came because of the generalized fear that we in Bombay and in India in general experienced in the 80s and 90s. For one thing, organized crime was making its presence felt very strongly in politics and economics, and the level of violence had escalated. So there were automatic weapons being used on the streets of Bombay in gangland hits, and my father and I were actually within earshot of one such encounter, although at the time we had no idea what was going on. And then there was the larger troubles of the subcontinent in terms of the religious fervor that was being ripped up by various political parties, the communal clashes, and then also the sort of tension on the border that made you think that a war might start, a possibly nuclear war might start any moment. So I think this idea of a gangster, this man who's carved his way into the underworld, he's very feared, but he is also very paranoid and full of fear, and therefore he's hiding inside this bunker, was something that arose from the environment, as it were.
But at that point, you weren't quite sure it was a bunker, and you weren't quite sure why he was hiding, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's generally how books start with me, is that I have this image that keeps coming back to me. And then if I start asking questions about why this is so, who these people are, and start following their lives, then the story starts to emerge.
The main protagonist, aside from Ganesh Gaitand, is a Sikh detective by the name of Sartaj Singh. He first pops up in a story called Kama.
Yes.
Which is in your collection, Love and Longing in Bombay. At what point did you realize, oh, I could use him again here?
When I finished Love and Longing in Bombay, I genuinely thought I had done with all the characters in that book. Oddly enough, as I was walking around Bombay, I still found myself staying with Sartaj and the people in his environment. I would see something or hear a story, and I would find myself thinking about it through Sartaj's point of view. Also, while I was writing that first story, which was a very different kind of story, it had nothing to do with organized crime, it was about a domestic murder, I had gotten to know some crime journalists and policemen, and I'd become pretty close friends with a couple of them and stayed in touch. So I think because I kept getting reminded of all of this, and then the thought of writing about crime started to become more and more important, this seemed like a natural fit. And that chapter that you're talking about with Gaitonde inside a bunker, when I first thought of it, it already had Gaitonde talking to Sartaj, just sitting outside trying to talk him out of his safe house.
Sartaj himself is a Sikh. Without knowing that there was the earlier story, I kept thinking, why did you make him a Sikh? And the only thing I could think of is that kind of puts him in the middle. He's neither Muslim nor Hindu.
Right. And also it makes him an outsider in the Bombay Police Department. Sikhs are a minority in India. Their largest concentration in their homeland is the Punjab. But in Bombay, they're a visible minority, and in the Bombay Police Force, there's even less than you would expect. I didn't actually realize this until I started writing about him. And I can make all kinds of after-the-game guesses, but I think he just came from, again, appeared to me as almost a fully formed character. Perhaps because I had very good Sikh friends when I was growing up, I learned Gurmukhi, I learned to write and read it, which is the language that is used in Punjab, the script that is. But after I started writing about him, then it became apparent that it was very useful to have him be an outsider, both in the larger politics of the city, but also within the department itself. He stays outside.
I read in an interview that you said the thing about Sikhs that you saw in Bombay, they were always imposing and very elegant and kind of distant.
I guess that I'm making a huge generalization, but I mean, I think more than even in Bombay, among my friends, I think Punjabis in general have a great sense of style, both Sikh and Hindu and otherwise, and flamboyantly so. I had some friends whose father especially were extraordinarily stylish men, and that really struck me always, with waxed mustaches and a great sort of bearing, an imposing bearing.
There's an exchange that you had at one point in your research, or maybe it was before, you ask a policeman, is there such a thing as a clean cop? And the policeman answered, if there is, he's not very efficient. Sartaj starts out clean, doesn't always stay that way for reasons that have to do with his finances. In your research, did you know all along about how corrupt it all is?
Well, you have a generalized sense of it. It's a subject that's been treated a lot in popular culture, especially in cinema and television. As a kid, you know, you grow up in this environment where corruption is as much a part of it as the air. You're always bribing. You see people bribing not just the policeman, but the guy at the ration store, guy who comes to fix your phones in your house wants a bakshish. He's from a government department. What I didn't know, and I should say as a bourgeois citizen, it was very easy for me to stand outside of all of this and say, this is ugly, it's horrible, corruption is, you know, the ruination of our culture. But once I started writing, I started to get very interested in more specific questions. Well, it exists, but how does it actually work? Who gets paid how much? How does the money move? Who does favors for whom? How do the flows of power and mutual benefit actually work within the department and then in a larger way outside? Once I started asking these questions, people were very forthright, as long as I was warning them that I would never, you know, damage them in any way.
There's a subplot that involves Sartaj taking a case because he's been bribed to take a case. Is this common?
Well, in cases that run the case of shaming or embarrassing somebody, people very much like to keep it off the books, as it were. You know, you sometimes try to solve the problem through non-governmental means. But the case that you're talking about is about a woman who's being blackmailed, and she very much desperately wants it not to become public. And if it becomes official, if it goes on the police record, there's no way that it's going to stay private. In many ways, I mean, it's a society which is based around ideas of honor and shame. And so what becomes public and what remains private is very important. Even though I might know that my neighbor is doing something wrong, as long as it never comes out into the public, as long as nobody ever says it, izzat or honor is maintained. And so to somebody like that woman, it's a terrifying thought that the knowledge of her wrongdoings will go outside. And so Sartaj is the only person that she can find to take care of this. I don't know if it's common, but I have seen and heard of it happen. I should say also that in an odd way, one of the reasons for the rise of the underworld and its increasing power is because of a thing that's related to this, which is the failure of the civic system, the courts, that is. So, for instance, the laws in Bombay about renting apartments or houses are very heavily weighed in favor of the tenant. So once you get into a house, it's very difficult for the landlord to get you out. If I've rented a house to someone, I want it back, I can't even raise their rents without going to court. And if I go to court, it'll take 18 years. So what people do is they go to their friendly neighborhood gangster, right, who knows exactly how much the property is worth. And so then he makes a deal with you and shows up at the house and makes your tenant an offer they can't refuse. So in many ways, the interstices of the civic culture, where there are gaps, extra constitutional authority sort of flows in to fill that up.
Is this one of the reasons, as you began to explore this, that the book took off beyond being the story of a gangster and a detective?
Yeah. I mean, I think I got really interested first in organized crime, but then realized fairly soon that you cannot talk about organized crime in isolation. There was a specific moment in the early 90s when I was just starting to think about the book, mid-90s, and I was asking a senior policeman in Bombay about that incident that I talked about earlier where my father and I had heard that shootout, which was actually a team of policemen cornering a very famous shooter, as they're called, a hitman, and a number of his companions, and then there was this afternoon-long gunfight that went on between them. So my friend, the policeman, was telling me about this, answering my questions, and then he said, look, I can tell you about that incident, how we gathered the intelligence, how the operation was planned and conceived and executed, but if you really want to understand what's going on, you have to go to Delhi and talk to these two people and then go further north and talk to so-and-so. What he was trying to get me to understand is that, for one thing, organized crime is always related to politics. And there's always an exchange of value. Both of them exist in conjunction through mutual profit and advantage. And so then from politics, you know, religion is a thing, or the uses of religion are a thing that gets knitted into all of this instantly. And then the larger context of the media, modern media, like cinema and television, and then what has been called the great game, the struggle between nation states for advantage and for territory in the subcontinent and beyond. I slowly found myself getting drawn in that direction, and that seems like a really far reach, except that the really direct link is that some of these gangs, the companies as they're called, are used by the local intelligence agencies for information gathering, for logistics, for moving people and cash across borders, and as extra constitutional arms. I mean, you want to preserve deniability, and you have something really nasty to do, you send off one of these guys to do it, and it gets done.
So suddenly the novel begins to have tentacles that reach out in all of these different directions.
Right.
The conflict, say, between Gaitande and Sartaj, then there's the conflict between India and Pakistan, as exemplified by Gaitande and the Pakistani gang lord Suleiman Issa.
Right, right. He's actually Indian, who's been first recruited but then basically run and owned in a sense by the Pakistani intelligence people, much as Gaitonde is run by Indian intelligence. And I should say that I'm not making this up. This is actually based on pretty well-known fact.
Are these people, Gaitande and Issa, are they based on real people then?
I wouldn't say in a one-to-one kind of way, but they're composites, but the political struggles are connected to these kinds of things, and these people get used is something that everyone knows and has been talked about a great deal again in India in the popular press. Yeah, so what happened was that what I found myself, instead of dealing with what I thought of as local crime on my street corner, I was suddenly dealing with this mesh, with this network of people and political agendas and history, in a sense, that was working its way through very ordinary people's lives. What seemed local revealed itself to be actually much more in a complex way, connected to things very far away.
Vikram Chandra, as the book expands exponentially almost, how do you try to maintain order out of this this chaos? It's almost as if the book becomes, in a way, Mumbai itself.
Right. What helped me immensely, about halfway through the writing of the book, I realized what I wanted to do was to construct a kind of mandala. Mandalas are interesting, iconic figures from the Hindu traditions and the Buddhist traditions. They're usually set up as squares or circles, and then there's often a main narrative thrust, you know, the birth of the Buddha or Krishna defeating his great enemy, which will be the central panel. But then in inset panels around that are other narratives, which at first glance seem disconnected by reason of plot. There seems to be no obvious kind of connection between them, or time. They're separated by time. But the artist, by putting them together, suggests a wholeness and a connection, and encourages you to see all of these seemingly disparate things in the same vision. And so that, I think, gave me a way to structure the book, which, without giving too much away, I should say, moves in circles, and there are cycles within cycles. And in fact, one of the great thematic interests that I found myself developing throughout the book was, how do we as human beings make order out of chaos? How do we find meaning in our lives by trying to figure out what's going on? Which seemed a particularly apt thing to think about in the space of a detective story, which traditionally always has been, we have the inexplicable sign at the beginning of the story, always the dead body. And then as the detective applies reason and tries to construct a narrative, a theory, more and more order is restored till at the end the meaning is revealed, everything is explained, and we have order in the universe once more, which I think is why we're so comforted by watching them obsessively and reading them. I hope Sacred Games doesn't provide that easy an order at the end. And my detective, I think I can say this without giving away too much in the way of a spoiler, is that the detective at the end of the story knows very little.
You're listening to an interview with Vikram Chandra, whose novel, latest novel, is Sacred Games. He does put pieces together, but by the time he puts the pieces together, the picture is so big
right.
that the pieces that he puts together to solve
right.
the crime becomes very small.
Right. The reader understands, but he only has fragments. And so he's left with, I think, which I suppose is the maybe the rather grim message of the book, which is that he's forced to make very, very painful choices. And as he puts it, he doesn't know why. And yet he ends up destroying lives, yet saving other lives, which is, I think, the way in which we grope for meaning in our own lives. And I think maybe that's what the great seduction of art and religion and all kinds of narrative are, is that they offer us a way of extracting order and meaning from the swirl that surrounds us.
It's interesting, then, that you make Sartre someone who doesn't believe in religion.
Right. He has a very sort of doubting faith. He thinks that it would be a nice thing to have faith, but he finds himself incapable of it almost. And yet, again, I should say that at the end there's a return to the center of his faith that, in a sense, revives him. I suppose reason finally can't offer us that kind of renewal or reassurance. It has to come from somewhere. I suppose what is finally belief.
You don't give much help to an audience of English speakers by putting the novel many, many places in the patois of Mumbai, and that's deliberate, right?
Right, right. Well, I mean, my intention at the beginning was actually very straightforward. I just wanted to use the English that we actually speak in India, and in Bombay in particular. Bombay is an intensely multilingual city in a very multilingual country. If I step out of my apartment in the city and walk down to the street corner, without exaggeration, I can say that I might hear 5 languages by the time I get to the end of the street.
How many do you speak?
Well, in my life, I've learned and lost, I think, 3 other Indian languages as my family shifted around India and when I was a child. I speak and write Hindi and English, and I can understand to some extent Punjabi, but I've lost most of what I had. There are other families which actually at home even are trilingual, because if you speak Gujarati, for instance, as your mother tongue, you have to know Hindi in North India to get by, and you learn English at school. So what happens is that people switch languages unselfconsciously and often. So if I were telling one of these stories in a bar in Bombay to a friend of mine, the English that I would be using would be sprinkled with Punjabi and Marathi and local underworld stuff that we all assume knowledge of. The audience that I think of when I write is very particular. It helps me a lot to focus, I think, as a writer. And it consists of people who know this environment and I can speak to without having to translate. I just use that language, and it seemed appropriate in the sense that to bring the city to life, to speak the patois, as you put it, off the city itself would be extremely useful. I wasn't thinking very far beyond those kinds of immediate urges when I was writing. So it's been interesting to listen to people react to this in places far away from Bombay. I should say that some of the slang, particularly the underworld stuff, is so local that even an Indian reader from South India, for instance, wouldn't
really
at first get the literal meaning.
There's a glossary in the back, and it helped a bit.
Right.
But on the other hand, you know, what you have to do is eventually, if you're going to read the book, you kind of
right.
play with context and go, okay, I have to just go with this.
Right.
I mean, there's a word, M-A-D-E-R-C-H-O-D.
Oh, that's a very bad word. I don't know if you should say it on the air.
Really?
Yeah.
And what does that mean?
Well, to put it politely, somebody who has relations with his mother. That and other sort of familial curses like that are fairly common. Much in the same way, I guess, if you listen to street speech in this country, you'd hear a number of words. But you're right. I hope the reader doesn't feel like going back to the glossary every instant. For me, one of the great pleasures of reading, especially a book from far away, as it were, is that you get introduced to the lingua franca and then the nuances of it, the world that surrounds it. And as an Indian reader, reading in books in English from an early age, this is something that I've sort of become very familiar and used to. It's normal to me. I mean, if you imagine me as a kid reading British children's fiction, which was very widespread in India among a certain class when I was growing up, I had no idea what a crumpet was, the breakfast English thing, right, or macaroon. I mean, if I read American fiction, even after being off and on here for a long time, sometimes there are things that escape me, you know, local stuff. Like, nobody in India, for instance, would know instantly why one went to the 7-Eleven to get a bottle of milk. An assumption of knowledge that is embedded in the language and the literature.
When you were studying literature over the years with people like John Barth, and Barth in particular deals with the outer fringes of popular literature, at least in his later work,
right.
Did any of these issues come up?
Yeah, he was very helpful for me in writing my first book. And again, in that book, there's the language, of course, but there's also in that a very heavy, explicitly sort of foregrounded use of Indian mythology and stories that are familiar to us. So we did, I think, at times have these issues pop up, and he was very open to reading things that one wouldn't understand at first encounter. And then I think in the way that you're talking about, both he and Donald Barthelme, actually, they're interested, I think, in the way that popular culture works and the way that what we call genre and literary fiction relate to each other, reject each other, and use each other, which I think for me in this book was something that I was thinking about.
Is that one of the reasons you chose to bring Bollywood in, or was that always going to be there just because of your own personal knowledge and connection?
I'm deeply interested in Indian cinema. One can't help be that way if you're thinking about contemporary culture in India. We've been making film for a long time, and I'm not sure how many people in the West might know about this, but the Lumiere brothers, about 6 months after they first demonstrated the mechanism in Paris, actually did a show in Bombay, and Indians started making films very soon after that. And so we've been making movies for more than 100 years, and especially in the post-independence era, cinema has become a very essential part of these kinds of national discussions that we've had about what it means to be Indian, what it means to be a nation state, what the changes that are going on mean, and what we're losing and what we're gaining. And especially in a culture or in a society where illiteracy has been and continues to be a very prominent fact, the visual media are the ones that everyone actually engages with, and we can talk about across class and regionality. And so if you walk around in anywhere in India, cinema is a part of the environment. The posters are on the walls. The transistor radios in little shops are playing the songs. And when you get on a train, the person across from you will be reading a film magazine. We all share this vocabulary. And I think especially in this book, there were some obvious connections. One, that the underworld is deeply interested in the film business. The film industry was not recognized by the government as a legitimate industry until fairly recently, so banks insured banks couldn't give loans for making films, which meant that you had these people called financiers who gave loans for making movies at high rates of interest, and you never asked them where the money came from.
One thing that struck me was, as the book goes on, and as Bollywood, and I guess the term is filmy, F-I-L-M-I, yeah, as that comes more into play, we begin to see, or the connection, or rather the disconnection between the conventions of filmy or Bollywood and actual real life. And it struck me that in some ways then, Bollywood is very much, not completely like the studio system we had here in the 30s, but on some level culturally very much like the 30s studio system.
Right. In reference to popular culture, my sort of take on it, and I suppose the book's approach to it, is kind of doubled in that the way the Indians use the word filmy is to describe something that seems too large, too melodramatic. Somebody like Gaitonde himself and his life, you know, from being nobody in Bombay to being a multimillionaire who controls enormous wealth and power, that itself is filmy. I think the book itself, and I'm deeply interested in this notion of representation and reality. And so that early in the book, Gaitonde starts telling us about his life, and then he relates a specific incident from it, and he says, I know you won't believe this because you've seen it already in 5 movies, right? And so we live in a time when the environment is so saturated with images and representations that we start to actually resist reality itself because it seems too film-like. That idea is used throughout the book. Later in the book, when Gaitonde is working with a screenwriter writing his movie that he produces, the screenwriter tells him the first time an audience sees something, it thinks it's real. The second time, it says this is cliched. And the third time, they just reject it because it seems too filmy. When the attack on 9/11 happens, Gaitonde is in Thailand, and he's woken up by his underlings to see this happening on television. And his first thought is, it's one of those American films. So in that way, popular culture sometimes has a notion of what is happening and what is about to happen that is extraordinarily acute and in some ways more than literary fiction, alert to what is coming down the pike. Gaitonde himself, you know, his reality, his inner vision, I think is contrasted or put right next to Sartaj's much smaller. So I wouldn't say that Bollywood or its narrative tradition is unreal. That would be like saying, I don't know, magic realism is unreal or opera is unreal.
Right.
Well, yes, so what? But the truths that it represents are something that can be very keenly felt and actually very close to what actually the world is.
Vikram Chandra, in writing the book, certain characters must have just captivated you and you kind of went, God, I love this guy or this woman. Who were the characters? This is a big novel with a lot of characters. Who are a couple of the characters that just grabbed you?
Well, I think for me, the most difficult chapter and the most satisfying one finally to write was Sartaj's mother is somebody that he sees, you know, as one sees one's mother, as a woman who has been a certain function to him all his life, but who seems opaque to him in many ways and who silences herself in reference to many things that have happened to their family. And so the opportunity of going back into her childhood was something that I was really wanting to do, and yet it was really painful because that was a painful time in history. And to confront that through the viewpoint of a child was something that was, I mean, technically it was hard to do, but I really enjoyed doing it. And then the other person that I like very much in another kind of way is the film actress Zoya Mirza, who is Ganesh Gaitonde's girlfriend, who survives him, which not many people do. And in fact, she thrives. And she's a girl from a very orthodox family in a small northern town who decides one day that she's going to be a film star and actually ends up doing just that. And I suppose that comes from me being on the peripheries of the Indian film business for the last few decades. So I've had time to watch people, young people, come into the industry, and some of them get eaten up, and, you know, very, very few of them actually go through this expansion. And I think especially for a woman in Bombay, the kind of steely will and resolve and self-possession that it takes to actually do that is something that one admires and one is frightened by at the same time. And I suppose that's what I like about Zoya.
These insets in the mandala, which came first, the idea of the mandala or the little stories and you needed a place for them?
Well, I knew that I was going to go back in history because I couldn't find a way to get the layered kind of experience that I wanted without doing that. So that, you know, if a bomb goes off in a Bombay train today, this is something that started 60-odd years ago and perhaps further beyond that. And so the sense in which events, faraway events, keep reverberating through our lives, and I mean the lives of very ordinary people going about their domestic tasks, was something that I very much knew that I wanted. But then the specific architecture of getting history in there was something that came with the mandala. Once I understood the story of the book or the structure of the book, I think it was about 300-odd pages, manuscript pages in, and I had to go back to page one and start writing again, which was frustrating but exciting because I knew then what I was doing.
And you knew you could illuminate from different angles at
right.
that point.
Right.
Vikram Chandra, now you born in New Delhi. You went to film school at Columbia. Was that because your mom's a film writer?
Well, yeah. Actually, what happened was that I've been writing fiction since I was a kid. I was a nerdy little kid with an internal life, and I used to make up these stories. But growing up in India in the 60s and 70s, to imagine yourself as a writer was impossible. I mean, particularly because I had seen my mother write and had seen the checks that she got from All India Radio for an hour-long play, you know, and it was very clear you couldn't survive off that. So there was always this question, you know, how are you going to make a living? So my undergraduate degree was actually in literature, but with a concentration in creative writing. So I wrote a novella for my senior thesis, but then again, this plaguing question of, well, how do you earn your bread? I've always loved cinema and been fascinated by it, and I thought, here's a world where I can make a living, if not as a writer, as an assistant of some sort. So I went off to film school intending to do just that, and then at film school found in the Columbia Library this book that became the basis for my first novel.
And that was an autobiography of a man named Colonel James Sikander Skinner?
Right, yeah. Yeah. He was a half-Indian, half-British officer and born in the late 18th century. So the book moves from the late 18th century to the mid-19th century, which is sort of the time in which colonialism, British colonialism, made its presence felt and set up its ideological basis and became very powerful, I mean, the paramount power.
That book is more, certainly more magic realist than this one.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, like I was saying, I love using Indian mythology and putting the Indian gods into an ordinary Indian day, manifesting them, you know, in the town.
What relationship do you think the Indian epics themselves play in either that novel or this one, either in form or content?
In the first one, it was much more obvious. I was using the tradition in which those are told, which is story within story. So the frame stories, and then a character starts telling a story, and then within that story, another character starts telling a story.
Well, that's John Barth, too.
Right, I mean, absolutely, yeah. You know, and Sherazade and the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, you know, which were the first stories that I actually remember hearing from my mother and my aunts.
When you read Barth, you must have holy cow.
Yeah, I mean, there was a huge sense of recognition and pleasure in his exuberance in the act of storytelling. Yeah. In fact, I just, in the best American short stories he has in 2007, the one edited by Stephen King, I had the pleasure of reading a new Barth story, and it was wonderful. It's called Toga Party, and I recommend it highly to everyone. But in this one, too, I think in the structure of it, obviously in the mandala way that draws from Indian traditions, and I think inevitably in the way that the book sets up its universe of connections and a variety of people passing each other by, hardly knowing each other and yet profoundly affecting each other's life, that sense of destinies that crash into each other, I think, is very much from the epics. And I suppose in some ways it's very unlike what we've come to think of as the closed world of the modern novel. The idea also of the moral education of the individual resulting in an epiphany. I think there are few epiphanies in this book. I'm suspicious of them.
Something I asked Salman Rushdie, which is an interview with him, and suddenly occurred to me, what's this Mumbai-Bombay thing? And he said, well, it's got political implications, which is why it became Mumbai. He also said that there, everyone still calls it Bombay.
Right. Well, when I was growing up, this multilingual city had many names, right? So if you were speaking Marathi, you said Mumbai. If you were speaking English, you said Bombay. In Hindi, you said Bombay. And I thought, I mean, and as many other people did, that this was a fairly equitable solution to the problem of what the city was, how to name it. And then in the 90s, we had a right-wing political party in a kind of Sons of the Soil nationalist move, nativist move. They made this one of their election planks that they were going to restore the original name Mumbai. And so their version of history is, and again, this is very plausible, that before the British ever got there and created the port, the local fishermen on the island worshipped a goddess named Mumba Devi, and therefore from Mumba Devi comes Mumbai. There's an equally plausible other story that when the Portuguese, before the British, first started settling in the islands, that when they first saw this huge natural harbor, they called it Bombay, good harbor. From there comes Bombay. So I think there's these alternative histories, and one of the things, the trends that's happened in India in the recent past is this effort to sort of wipe away multiplicity and replace it with a unitary vision of what Indians should be and what India is. And it seems to me this is a part of that. And in actual speech still, again, depending on what language you're speaking, who you're speaking to, people flip between the others. I sometimes call it Mumbai if I'm speaking Hindi.
Well, it seems to me that the idea of creating a unitary vision, from what I've read, Vikram Chandra and Sacred Games, in essence, that's almost anti-Indian, because India itself, what makes India India, both, you know, and on a social as well as a culinary level, right, is the mixing of all of the spices.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and I think that's why the effort is so urgent to them, because I think the great fear on that side of the political fence is that it is this multiplicity which has resulted in disunity. And therefore, we have been exploited and dominated in recent history by quote-unquote outsiders, right? And they don't just limit this to the British. They would argue that the Mughal Empire was also consisted of outsiders. And therefore, there's all these refashionings of the idea of what it means to be India on the basis of this kind of historical vision. And it's very much, I think, also a fear that is obsessed with certain ideas of strength and virility, right? So this idea that we've lost our honor in the world, in order to get respect, we must be strong, and strong in this particular kind of unitary armed way.
But are these unitary people any less corrupt? I mean, were these the people in charge in the 90s when Enron was doing its damage in India?
No, I mean, that was one of the promises, that because we are religiously minded, because we are aware of ethics, we are clean. And I think time has revealed that they're not at all clean.
That's not much different from the United States.
I think there's a kind of parallel or at least analogous kind of political ideology that is at work in various places in the world. And I think especially because we experience the modern world sometimes as a kind of confusion, as a kind of blurring. And therefore, then notions of identity become really hinged on these kind of singular notions of what it means to be anything.
Vikram Chandra, you finished Sacred Games. It was published a while ago, and it took 7 years. You have not begun work on another novel except in your head at this point?
Yeah, well, I realized when I finished this book that I'd been writing pretty much continuously without a break for almost 20 years. So as an experiment, I decided to give myself some time off, a holiday as it were, and catch up on all my reading and watching of films and some travel. So I've been doing that so far, and I have sort of vague ideas in my head that I've been trying to keep at arm's length, because once I start writing, it will again inevitably turn into an obsession.
Well, you teach creative writing at Berkeley,
yes.
And you were taught creative writing from a couple of master writers. How much can you really teach?
Well, you can't teach talent, but you can teach craft. And so I think what you learn by being in a classroom is the vocabulary, how to look at a piece of fiction and try and see what it's doing on the page and in your head and, you know, your body. And sometimes a lot of the education is being around other writers, and especially good writers. And I mean, for instance, being in the same room with Donald Barthelme and watching him just read down a page and dissect sentences, and his ability to spot a comma that was disturbing the rhythm and then rearrange that and make it work was an education, because you learn how to listen and you learn what to do or attempt to do. I've heard this you know, the writing program system described as a peculiarly American institution. But there's actually a quite old Indian analog to this, a kind of apprentice system that used to work in poetry and music, where young people would apprentice themselves to an ustad, a master. And then, you know, the legends, of course, like in the Kung Fu movies are, is that the master would make you clean the dishes for the first year to test your resolve and your seriousness. And then as you moved in this milieu, you would start to learn the particulars of your craft, and your work would be examined by the ustad. And then finally the ustad would introduce you to the world at large as a poet or a singer or whatever. So sometimes the American system seems to me an institutionalized version of that, which still exists to some extent in India.
One final question. As someone who travels back and forth between Bombay and Berkeley, how do they view America and the Bush administration and what happened in Iraq?
That's a large question.
I know.
But I think I'm not going too far afield to say with trepidation and fear, not just in the way of the readiness to intervene on the other side of the world, but also I think in more recent times to see how badly it's been managed, which has been a kind of revelation, I think, to me and to many other people, because despite Vietnam and so forth, we had this idea that Americans, above all, were pragmatists and on the ground would deal with things in a way that more or less dealt with the reality at hand. So this kind of the ideological mission and the certainty with which people in high office seem to believe in that, and the discounting of actual knowledge on the ground, that's been a very interesting thing to watch from outside. And strange. I mean, it demonstrated for us, I guess, how ideology can override the real and the practical.
Which you see all the time in India now, too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You've been listening to an interview with Vikram Chandra, whose latest novel is Sacred Games, now out in trade paperback. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.